If you're ever on the BYU campus and you're not averse to police arrest, try the following. Pick up a rock, throw it into a crowd of students or faculty, then find the person or persons on the receiving end and ask them if they play an instrument, if they can carry a tune. If they answer no to your questions, chances are they're being modest. This is a campus of musicians, self-proclaimed or otherwise, even discounting the official groups, men's and women's chorus, the chamber orchestra, the brass ensemble, among many others. You still have a massively toe-tapping, knee-slapping, hand-clapping musical campus. I don't know how other schools would fare in my throw a rock into a crowd experiment, and by the way, I'm not seriously suggesting that you throw anything at anyone. I, however, did spend the last several weeks sticking a microphone in people's faces, and the sounds that came out of them, the sounds of BYU's informal music culture, make for some pretty good radio. They're the sounds of tunnel singers, of BYU idol stars, the sounds of a local band practice,
the world outside such a wreck,
or of a beginning guitar class. They're the sounds of amateurs, in other words, of the little guy, of you and me. Only a fraction of the music that happens on this campus happens in a concert hall or an auditorium. Much, if not most of it, is just the natural creative upwelling of the culture. The information systems major, who dedicates several hours a week to his band. The biochemistry professor who still finds time to play his guitar. The hundreds of students who take hours out of their week to sing hymns in a tunnel, or belt show tunes from a makeshift stage, or play chords or notes on an instrument, any instrument, simply to unwind after classes. It's a campus of hummers and strummers, as Professor Larry Green calls them, and Green ought to know. He teaches them how to strum. Not all the interviews I did for this story were audiogenic, but the ones with Green were, even when he wasn't playing. During our chat, Green sits in his office/practice room and just oozes the musical vibe. The weight of the guitar-playing campus is on his shoulders, and yet he slouches in his chair like he was born comfortable.
Are you the guitar faculty or part of the guitar faculty?
No, I am the guitar faculty. Like, I am the state, you know, kind of thing.
Green tells me his students range from serious guitar aficionados to people just looking to have a good time, the hummers and strummers. He also tells me about his own little side gig, a band he plays in with his wife.
So that, I get to keep an eye on her. But she keeps an eye on me, too.
What does she play?
She plays bass.
Oh, okay.
Robin, the famous Robin Green.
Well, aren't you a little afraid, whenever you incorporate a girl into the band, it becomes a girl band, she becomes the focus of attention, and you guys are just like props.
Well, yes, I mean, that's kind of, would that be marriage, wouldn't it?
Later on, I end up stopping by Green's beginning guitar class. I show up to the classroom, open the door, and immediately, the sound of guitars, a pleasant cacophony, pours out of the room. Throughout the period, Green is in his usual form, laid back in jeans and a t-shirt, chomping gum, cracking jokes. He reviews what they've already learned about finger positioning, chord progressions, strumming patterns, all the basics. If they remember nothing else from college, he says, let them remember these things. After class, I catch up with Green. I ask him why he thinks non-music majors go to the trouble of taking a guitar class.
It gives them a skill they can enjoy their whole life. People love the sound of music. They love the sound of particular instruments. So I think, coupled with the communicative qualities of the spoken word, it's great.
I ask Green if he doesn't think the romance quotient of the guitar draws a lot of students. Does his class equip them to serenade?
Only if they sing on pitch to begin with and they dress right.
Josh Pruitt is a student in the class and a civil engineering major. He pulls out his guitar and shows me a few of the tricks he's learned. He says he looks at the class as a down payment on a lifelong pastime.
Just any basic finger picking.
Pruitt says he doesn't have a vested interest in music, but it still makes for a nice reprieve at the end of the day.
Occasionally I've had enough with my books or whatever, and I'm like, it's time to actually enjoy myself.
A step up from the hummers and strummers, in terms of intensity at least, are the contestants in the BYU Idol competition. BYUSA sponsors the events, which draw a number of what I think are hugely brave contestants and some pretty substantial crowds as well. I show up one night to catch the final round of the semester-long competition. It's a few weeks shy of Christmas break, and the atmosphere is festive, to say the least. As the competition gets underway, all the American Idol tropes emerge. The talented or not-so-talented contestants, the nice or not-so-nice judges, and a crowd of swooning, screaming fans that gets to pick the winner.
I've regretted so many performances where I don't just let it all out, so I just gave it all I got, so kind of showed them what I had. So.
That's Amy Whitcomb. I speak to her just minutes after she wins the whole shebang singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. At the end of the show, the audience cheered for the contestant they like most. The cheer volume registered in a handy decibel meter, and Whitcomb came out the clear favorite. She got my clap votes anyway, though I suspect she didn't need them.
Basically, I just have the best friends ever, because they called everyone and everyone just came out here, so I was really lucky as far as that goes.
Oh, and one other thing before I let Whitcomb take us out of the section. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the delicious irony of the aforementioned handy decibel meter. That meter, you know, the one we screamed at as loud as we could, is the same meter that BYU breaks out for volume control at on-campus dances and rock shows and such. Anyway, it made my Christmas a little merry. Another semester-long tradition also features singing, as well as swooning, screaming fans, as well as really outgoing people, come to think of it. So maybe tunnel singing is like BYU Idol in a more enclosed space? I don't know. In any case, it's tunnel singing, and I suspect it needs little introduction. A bunch of students, a bunch of sidelong glances, and a bunch of hymns sung in a tunnel every Sunday night. Word on the street is that it started back in the early 90s when an enterprising RA scared up enough freshmen to sing echoey, presumably rousing renditions of the hymns. They did it to keep the Sunday spirit alive. The singings have been going strong ever since. Nowadays, though, you get debates like this one, culled from the 100-hour board, an online chat forum for students, and performed by BYU magazine editors Peter Gardner and Jeff McClellan.
All tunnel singing is an excuse for preemies and freshmen to get together and flirt.
Well, I don't quite agree with that. I went tunnel singing back before my mission, and I enjoyed it a lot. And I didn't flirt with anyone.
So, the jury's still out. All I can say is that the students I talked to said the spirit was the draw. It's an early spring night when I show up for my first tunnel singing experience. About 100 students gather under the bridge near the entrance to the Marriott Center. Admittedly, most of the students look younger. But by younger, I only mean that fewer of them are prematurely balding, like yours truly. We start off with an echoey, rousing rendition of Hope of Israel. And then a slightly less rousing take on Oh My Father. Since it's near the end of another semester, lots of the guys have mission calls to announce. So people stop singing and sit down as the missionaries-to-be announce their travel plans. One kid's headed to Poland, Warsaw, another to Brazil, Sao Paulo, and so it goes.
Jordan Sarson, I'm going to the Czech Prague mission.
Whereupon the tunnel singers break into Call to Serve, with some of the more enthusiastic ones marching in place, and many of them ad-libbing between the lines.
As a triumph song we sing,
a few days after tunnel singing, I decide to check in on the local band scene. My friend Nate Graves is in a band with his brother Seth, and one night I sit in on a practice session, or jam session to the initiated.
I really like that song.
Nate, an information systems major at BYU, lives with a few other guys in a house south of campus. When I show up, Nate's in his room, tuning up his acoustic electric guitar and his bass. When Seth shows up a few minutes later, the two of them get down to business. With Seth on guitar and vocals and Nate on electric bass, they play a recent song called Mother.
Mother, may I live more like you. Embrace my friends and my enemies too. till I'm worn through.
I should also mention that in the corner of the room is a small drum kit, which Nate or Seth add into the mix when they're feeling organic. A lot of what they record, though, they record without live drums, on Nate's computer. On the computer screen right now is a virtual soundboard, lots of knobs and buttons and knobs.
What is all this gadgetry?
This is the modern world of recording. Like, this song is mostly sequenced stuff with like some live guitar added in.
After the practice winds down, I ask Nate and Seth the questions I've been asking students for weeks now. If not for money, if not for your major, then why do you play? Why music?
For me, I mean, the reason why I've spent money to have instruments and equipment so I can record is just so I can kind of make a record of the ideas that I have. I guess in the same way that if you were a writer, you would carry a notebook around with you or a laptop, or if you were an artist, you would bring a sketch pad with you. I mean, it's a part of your creative self. I think even in among the more informal music scene, everyone kind of still has like this, at least I do, and at least all the people I've played with, they all kind of have this dream that somehow they will make it big as a musician, even though all of us will, we'll talk about how bands have sold out and, you know, lost the true meaning of making music. But I mean, I think everyone kind of like, they have this deep down desire to like achieve stardom, but I think also everyone's also still very aware that music in almost every case doesn't pay the bills.
I ask Seth if he thinks he'll ever give up music, if he'll ever grow out of it.
I'm gonna say no, pretty much a flat out no. Like, it's such a big part of my life right now, and like I can see it in our family and like our relatives. They're, you know, getting up there in their age, and they still have the greatest jam sessions, like when we get family get-togethers.
Yeah, it gets pretty intense. I mean, there'll be one or two people on the fiddle, two or three people on the guitar, someone on the harmonica, and then everyone else singing.
Yeah, and then they all take turns like soloing, and it just seems like something that gets almost sweeter with time. Like, they enjoy it so much, and I enjoy it so much right now, but I think it's always gonna be something that's really precious to me.
A few days after my visit with Nate and Seth, I go to see their father, Professor Stephen Graves. Like Nate and Seth, I remember his guitar playing from long ago camping trips. I remember his clear, unself-conscious baritone voice. Graves now teaches in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at BYU. It's finals week when I stop by, and Graves is in his office to field any last-minute questions from students.
Hello again.
Hi.
At my request, by the way, Graves has brought his guitar. I'm hoping he'll resurrect a few campfire favorites.
All right. I'm going away to leave you, love. I'm going away for a while. But I'll return to you someday, though I go 10,000 miles.
A few minutes later, Graves obliges my request to play some songs of his choosing. He does one by Woody Guthrie, one by the Carter Family, one by a folk group he doesn't even remember. They're just old songs, he tells me, and he likes them, and that's enough. Enough, it seems, to swell the mystic chords of memory, to borrow a phrase from Lincoln. Enough to record your feelings with, and enough to remember them by. Enough to inspire musical expression without the promise of a paycheck, without a stage or an audience much larger than a few family and friends. It's music, and we do it because we like it, and that's enough. For BYU Magazine, I'm Ryan McElvain.
Cease to be, this world will lose its motion, love, ere I prove false to thee, ere I prove false to thee.